You are listening to Punk News Podcast 408. We are back in the saddle again. Back in the saddle again.
I'm back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly Jimson wheat. Back in the saddle again, riding the range once
and welcome back. This is the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile. We got a pretty cool episode tonight. We got a pretty cool episode. We're going to be talking about money, musicians making money. We're going to be talking about Target making money. We're going to be talking... Oh, Adam White, I see you at the elderly man that ran away from the nursing home. We're going to be talking about that crazy story. And we're going to be talking about a lot of cool videos, a lot of unusual videos, and some other stuff as well. I am here with Features Editor... No, I'm Features Editor, John Gentile. I'm here with News Editor, Reviewer, Reviews Writer, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, what's happening? How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really excited to talk about the Nightbirds video and a few other things. So I'm glad I'm on this week.
Nightbirds video is real cool. We are also here with Managing Editor, Adam White. Adam White, what's happening? I believe you were in the Arctic this past weekend or something like that.
I was in the Maritimes, but that's not the Arctic.
It's close.
It's not at all. My wife and I went out east, from a Canadian standpoint, out east, and went to a music festival out in New Brunswick for 3 or 4 days over the last weekend, and it was lovely.
And who was the best act you saw? Who was the best act?
Oh God, who was the best act I saw? I'm going to say that I had the most fun. Oh God, there was a lot. There was a lot at this thing. I don't know.
Sugar Ray.
Okay, fucking. All right. So I can. Huh? Yeah, Sugar Ray. Okay, I'll give you four answers to this question.
Okay.
Because I'm not being diplomatic. There is a singer from Ontario named Carly Runciman. She has a band called Boyhood. Mm. They play this like really like cool kind of like sultry, like slow burn rock stuff, and like she has a record called Bad Mantras that came out, and like she fucking was amazing. Like her show was so good. I have five answers to this. Okay, so Boyhood was really good. You should go see Boyhood if they're ever in town. Like really cool, like just like slow burn, nice stuff. B.A. Johnson, John. Mm. B.A. Johnson plays at like 1:30 in the morning in this restaurant that was otherwise, as far as I understand it, closed and condemned, but they just sort of opened it back up just to do shows in, but like just like the midnight shows. And so BA just wrecked this stinky, disgusting, should be closed for health reasons bar. So that was great fun.
Adam, is your wife like B.A. Johnson, or does she like the fact that you like B.A. Johnson and that's why she tags along?
No, man, she's into it. She's into the B.A. I would like to think that she's into it. But
so you and your wife are of one heart, one mind.
Yes. I'll say yes.
So it's
one
not,
heart, one mind.
It's not like a sitcom where it's like a mismatched couple. It's a matched couple, if you will.
That is absolutely true. And at the moment, at the end of his set, which he always does when B.A. stampeded into a washroom to sing his last song in the bathroom, he stampeded into the women's washroom in this disgusting, otherwise closed bar. And I did not go in there because outside of any of the washrooms, this bar smelled like piss and was disgusting. I dared not venture.
I have a washroom story of my own, but please continue, Adam.
Plus, like 300 people went in this washroom, and I'm like, I'm not going to go in this hot, stinky, never cleaned washroom with a million people. Anyways, so BA was really good.
Was this Sappy Fest, Adam?
Yeah, this was Sappy Fest, which is in Sackville, New Brunswick. This is a town of about 5,000 people. So, yeah, all right. So what do I got here? I got BA. I got Boyhood. The headliner, one of the nights, was a... act from Toronto by the name of Bonje. Bonje is a two-piece they play sort of like dancehall reggae inspired like R&B stuff. Just the singer and a DJ kind of thing. Bonje was super compelling and super amazing to watch, but there was this moment near the end of the Bonje set where I swear to God, everyone started making out. I've not had this experience at a show where all of a sudden you are in the crowd in front of the stage and things are just like bumping along and like it's great and it's an amazing vibe. And then all of a sudden you look around and everyone is fucking making out, but that happened. And it haunts me.
So anyway, as well.
Bonje is, I should have, but yeah, Bonje is pretty amazing. So that was cool. Okay, one night we are in a, let's say the Canadian, do you guys have legions? You don't have legions,
yeah,
do
Legion
you?
Hall? What sure.
You have legions? Or what do you call them? You call them like VFW halls or something?
Well, Legion Hall, VFW Hall, yeah.
Same deal, right? I'm in one of those.
Of Foreign Wars, that's Legion Hall.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So in Canada, it's just called the Legion. So I'm in a Legion Hall, like 1 a.m. the one night. So there is a band that is called Rotten Column that is basically everybody from Tough Age plus a couple of their friends who have formed this band where the bass player from Tough Age, she sings in Rotten Column exclusively. And normally, like when she sings Tough Age songs, you know, she seems... I don't know why I'm not naming her. Her name's Penny Clark. When Penny sings Tough Age songs, she seems like she's really thinking them through, and she's very contained, let's say, you know, has her shit together. Rotten Column is basically a bunch of songs with her singing where she's trying her best to sort of like look and sound like Johnny Rotten, for the best that I can describe.
Oh, that's
it.
Cool.
It's like, it's her being nuts and the rest of the band just sort of being nuts. And all the songs are just like goofy and crazy, but we're in this hall. It's 500 degrees because there's no air conditioning in there. You know, but it was just like the sweaty, insane kind of end of the night. So that was really cool. And then, oh God, that was four. I said I had five. Shit, it was five. It was five, John. Oh, yeah. The Burning Hell. The Burning Hell are a band that I should play them, actually. I should maybe play them on this episode instead of what I was going to play. The Burning Hell are a Canadian band, of course, but they are for some reason, really huge in England and Scotland and you know, Ireland and all these areas. And they spend most of their time touring over there. It is a band that's fronted by a gentleman named, oh God, I'm gonna fuck it up, like Matthias something or other, eccentric dude with a beard. He writes this like super literate sort of like storytelling indie rock that's kind of goofy and kind of funny. There's some. Like a bit of like, say, like a There Might Be Giants sort of like vibe to some of it, because it's, you know, it's him just sort of like rambling out these like long mile a minute stories at times. They're funny. But he played at, you know, I think it was like the Sunday afternoon. It was like the last set, you know, during the Sunday afternoon show. And I was pretty day drunk when he went on, and my wife and I like love a lot of his songs, and it was just like, it was wonderful. It was like everyone's singing along to these songs because we all know them because they're all hilarious, and he's going and, oh shit, I'm gonna throw in a six. John, I'm throwing in a six.
All right.
This is a full-fledged fucking review right now.
It is. How about
you? It is. So, okay. The way this festival was set up is that, you know, the whole reason that Sackville exists is that it's a university town. So there's a big university in the middle of the city. So we were, that was good for us because we were staying in the dorms as our accommodations. They had a big tent that was set up in the middle of like the one street that is the downtown. That was where all the, you know, where all the bands were playing, except for, in, you know, that was like the main stage, right? Like there were club shows at night, but that was the main stage. There was a few times where they had something that was atypical, and they needed to put it somewhere, and they would run these shows out of like the auditorium of the music schools. Well, the music department section of this university. So we go into this auditorium and sit down and watch this, watch a guy named Jeremy Dutcher. Jeremy Dutcher is a classically trained tenor opera singer. He is a really good pianist, but he is also a, and I don't know what nation he is from exactly, but he's an indigenous guy from up here. So he participated, he had this project over the past few years where they found wax cylinders, you know, like really early, like recording medium, like wax cylinders, right? Before there were records or anything like that, they would record audio onto those. So they found these wax cylinders that where some anthropologist 100 years ago had went out to basically like the tribe of his ancestors and recorded like 100 songs that they were singing that were these indigenous songs. Now, that language is basically dead. There's like 100 people in the world that speak that language anymore. So this guy gets the songs off the wax cylinders, learns the language, learns the songs, composes music on the piano to go with them, and then like arranges them. And he puts together this collection of music where he's basically like resurrecting a language that no one's heard anymore. And so he comes on stage and he, you know, sits down at a piano and he's playing, you know, playing these songs on the piano, like singing in an operatic voice and just putting this stuff in the music. And he's putting this stuff into like contemporary forms, and he has an iPad sitting on the piano, and there'd be times where like he would stop singing but keep playing the piano and then hit a button on the iPad and play a snip of the 100-year-old wax cylinder recording of his ancestors singing the same song, and then like he would like then like chime back in once like a little like 30-second clip of the 100-year-old cylinder was done. And like, so just like from a fucking academic standpoint, what he was doing was super, super interesting, but he was insanely good. Just like incredibly good with what he was performing and what he was singing and the way he was delivering it. And he was one of these guys that had a complete command of audio and of his voice and of how like things work and how sound resonates. There was one point where he turns to the crowd and he says something like, "Oh, you know, there's a lot of musicians that are here. Maybe we can pull this off. I want half you guys to just start singing a G, just like make like a G noise." So everyone starts like singing a note. I can't do this cause I suck. Right. And then he has like everyone else sing something that's like, I'm going to mess up the actual music terminology here, but like an octave higher or whatever it is. And it creates this drone effect. So the whole room starts to just resonate and drone with this noise that he's making. And he kept doing things like that that I've never seen anyone do. Like there was a certain point where like he was sort of walking around the stage and he had a like this shaker instrument that was some indigenous instruments, and he was just singing a cappella. And then he walked over to the piano and like leaned his whole body into the piano and just started to bellow into the piano, but he knew the acoustics of it so well that it just like resonated out and filled the room, and it was just crazy. Like the whole thing was crazy. So that wasn't just that was one of these like once in a lifetime performances that was just nuts. So yeah,
that's cool.
This shit all happened.
By the way, something else that I saw on Instagram that happened at Sappy Fest was our photographer Stephen McGill got engaged.
Yeah, he did. Steven's the guy that takes a lot of the photos in Toronto that we run on Punk News. And so we met up with him the day before. We actually stayed the night at his family has a cottage that's a little bit out of town there. So we hung out at the cottage with him and with this van full of music writers that he showed up with that were all like people from the Toronto scene that he knows. He drove 15 hours to get there too.
Fuck.
Like, me and my wife flew on a plane like big shits, and he drove 15 hours in a van to get there. It's insane. But yeah, so Steven and his girlfriend had been going to Sappy together for 7 years, and we got there and like the first thing that happened was he proposed to her. So yeah, that was cool.
Well, it sounds cool. I got a quick bathroom story myself. Last Friday, I saw Painted Black amazing. There's a reason why Paint It Black is considered one of the greatest modern hardcore bands. It's because they are. They are amazing. Before them, Screaming Females played. Screaming Females played a bunch of stuff from the new album. Screaming Females is untouchable. They really are an amazing, amazing band. Before that, a band called Bacchae played. Bacchae's from D.C., but they kind of play kind of like early West Coast punk. Avengers, Owls in the Bags, and they are a cool new band. However, I was at the venue. Asbury Park had the famous venue, the Lane. That was the name of it. The Lanes, the Asbury Park Lanes. There was a bowling alley that was a famous venue spot, but it got bought out, and now it's kind of a whole corporate thing. So the people that used to work at Asbury Lanes now are at this place called House of Independence. House of Independence is what you would call a very progressive venue. I go to take a whiz. I see a sign that says all gender inclusive bathroom. So I'm looking around. I'm like, I'm trying to make sure I'm not going in the wrong bathroom. It says all genders. It's got a guy, a girl, and kind of like a mix, you know. And I'm like, well, I guess I can go in this bathroom. So I go on in. There's urinals. I'm taking a whiz. Meanwhile, women are walking in and out while I got my wang hanging out taking a whiz. Here's my question. What's interesting about politics is even though politics is often presented as a continuum, to a degree it's almost like a circle. Like, generally speaking, the right side is considered being pro-gun. But if you go way, 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 way far left, then those guys are pro-gun as well. You know, kind of like Black Panthers and other people too. So it's kind of like a circle. You know, so I'm in the bathroom with my wang hanging out and women are walking in and out. And the idea behind, I think, gender inclusive bathrooms is to make it so everybody's comfortable. But are women comfortable? Me with my wang hanging out taking a whiz. Honestly, I wasn't comfortable. Are we getting what we're trying to get at with the gender inclusive bathroom? You know, like I thought gender inclusive bathroom meant it was like one stall. You know what I mean? And anybody can use it, which I think is good.
Generally, when I see this, it's one stall. And
but it so wasn't, Adam. It was like a men's bathroom, but anybody could go in. And so women are walking. Honestly. I mean, women are like doing their hair in the mirror and stuff. And I'm sitting there literally 4 feet away out in the breeze, baby. You know what? You know what I'm saying?
I think the best – I mean – when it comes to public bathrooms in general, for me, I always head for the stall. I don't care if it's just guys or whatever you are in. I just aim for the stall regardless. Most privacy, that's probably took some getting used to, John.
I mean, I thought it was.
I can empathize.
I thought it was gender inclusive, but it was like mainly guys and there was like a girl somewhere. But it was really gender inclusive. You know? I mean, honestly, like I saw dudes in there. So I'm like, oh, this must be, we're going to go take a whiz. And these girls start walking in and I'm free and easy, you know? The question is this method achieving is it curing the symptom that we're trying to cure?
All right. So first of all, I tell the story. Of this amazing artistic experience, and you follow up with like, I'm not sure if I should have been holding my dick at this time. So that's weird.
Welcome to the punk podcast.
All right. So I think this is one of these situations where if you are going to do gender inclusive bathrooms properly, you probably have to lay out your building to accommodate those properly, which is to say, you know, have a bunch of stall kind of things and have maybe like a shared mutual area that has like sinks and stuff like that, and you can pull that off without really changing the amount of floor space that you would have needed otherwise to have separate male and female bathrooms. That's the real answer. I don't think you can half-ass it by just taking like a men's room full of urinals and just slapping something on the door that's like, you know, come in here if you want, whatever. Because you want to think about it the other way, John. Someone could have walked in there and been like, you know, there was just some guy standing there with his dick, and I don't know why he wasn't in his stall. And, you know, the opposite happens. So it's probably a, you know, good intentions, but maybe do some renos.
Well, but I don't think that situation is making anybody more comfortable. You know what I mean? Anyways, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We got some good mail this week. I lost track of it. Give me one second. Here we are. Our first letter is from longtime writer Neil McDougall. McDougal, Liverpool, Neil. Neil, I'm just going to paraphrase the first half of your thing just because we're running short on time. My Zorn track did not get played, so I'm going to play it this week. The issues that you addressed, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised in the future. Second half of Liverpool, Neil's email. What I wanted to talk about today is Rebellion Festival in Blackpool, England, which ends today, August 5. It is the biggest yearly punk rock festival in the world, but I haven't heard you guys mention it once in all these years. Rebellion Festival has been happening since 1996 in Blackpool. It was originally called Holidays in the Sun before changing its name to Rebellion in 2007. Every year, over 300 acts perform at the festival over a four-day period, usually spread over the first weekend in August from Thursday to Sunday. And unlike other festivals, this one has stayed 100% true to its punk rock roots. No incorporating metal or hip indie bands. Take note, Riot Fest. This year, the headliners included the Buzzcocks, Lagwagon, the Vandals, Theater of Hate, the Exploited, Angelic Upstarts, GBH, Subhuman, Stifler of Fingers, Cockney Rejects, UK Subs, 999, Vice Squad, the Dickies, and Pill. And I'm going to add, this is John G speaking, Jugettes also played. The lineup is stacked. People attend from all over the world. It's a huge success every year and raises tons of money for charity, too. It deserves your attention and mention, I think. I'm planning on going back to it next year. Anyway, that's it for me for now. As always, stay free from Liverpool, Neil. I agree. We should cover Rebellion Fest. I would say the one criticism of Rebellion Fest, I'm surprised that punk guys can be so anti-metal, because to me, punk and metal are very closely related. And like, is Amoebics punk or metal? Is Anti-Sect punk or metal? You know, tough to say. I mean, is early Slayer punk or metal? I would say the one Rebellion Fest has an amazing. I mean, it is punk, mostly UK punk, but it is punk, baby. The one criticism I have is that it's almost all older bands. There's really not that many newer bands there, and I think. I'm not really dissing Rebellion Fest. Rebellion Fest, I would say, is very good. I'd give it an A-. But if it wanted to be an A+, I think they could add a few newer punk bands to say punk rock is old, but it's new too, and we want to cover all generations.
Was he talking about us covering it on the podcast or on the site? Because I'm pretty sure we cover it every year on the site.
Probably both. You know, I mean, we cover it less than
It's one of those things where, like, you look at the. You look at the lineup on here, and if we were to judge all of the music festivals that we're faced with by the lineup and how closely the lineup, say, matches up with whatever, like, the mission statement of punk news is, something like this, on that merit, deserves as much attention as we give, say, Fest, which is not a single article, but is a whole like all-consuming. You know, it's a season. Like Fest is like the weather, right? Like we talk about it for months, and you know, before we talk about it, you know, what's going on while it's there. You know, we talk about announcements of individual bands happening. We do all sorts of coverage and things like that. So something like this, like on a, you know, does it match with what we want to do with punk news? Yeah, this totally fits that. I think what that runs into is just the reality of, you know, not enough bodies, and the bodies that we have are probably not going to be able to go to something like this. So they're going to focus in on the things that they, you know, they not only can talk about, but can experience. And we have a mostly North American staff. So I think that's like the sad reality.
We should cover Rebellion more next year. I will make it a point to try to cover it somewhat more. A lot of good interviews one can get from Rebellion, and those bands are pretty open to interviews, generally speaking. So, yeah,
man. Let's go, John. You're paying.
Listen, Adam, you and me, if you're going, Adam, I'll pay. You and me, John and Adam's adventure over to the UK. We'll wear bondage pants. We'll put safety pins through our nose. We'll get mohawks. We'll punk it up, Adam. We will punk it up. Tell your wife you're going for a week. This is from Kedel from Norway. Hi, guys. I started listening to your podcast earlier this year, and I have not any plans of stopping now. My girlfriend and I traveled all the way from Norway to attend Montebello Rock Fest in 2016 just because it was an amazing lineup and cheap plane tickets. I don't really see a big problem in having a big festival just containing hard rock, metal, and punk. It's a great way to experience a lot of bands you like. And if you are not a music snob, you are probably into some of the bands from other genres playing at the festival as well. It seemed like it's looked down upon to attend big generic festivals like this. The only correct way, it seems, to be attending a small DIY festival or go to shows on a regular basis. it might be preferable, but why is it not allowed to go out and have a big rock festival once in a while as well? Come on, it's fun. From Keitel, and listen, you can't argue with that. You won't find me arguing with the argument it's just fun. If it's fun, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, if that's your thing, go do your thing.
I think Keitel brings a decidedly European attitude, which, you know, Europe loves its gigantic rock festivals. They love it, you know. And quite amusingly, dance music is bigger in Europe than it is in the States, but like, Europe loves its rock festivals. So I don't know. I mean, there's something to be said for both, you know. There is something to be said to be a smaller, more intimate venue, but it can be fun to go to a 150 bands, you know, with just a whole bunch you like, and you hang out with your friends and have a good time and rock out. So listen.
My main problem with Rock Fest is that it's called fucking Rock Fest, and that its logo is a guitar. Like, it's obvious fest. Like, just give it a name and an identity, and I would shut up about it.
Well, listen, Keitel, you do you. We support you at Punk News. And Keitel, if you want to do a review, submit it, and we will run it. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.com. We love getting your mail. Let's see here. I'll play the first song here. This is Zorn. This is a really cool band in Philadelphia. It's kind of like a death rock band. The main singer, I actually just saw them again recently. The main singer dresses like Dr. Frankenfurter from Rocky Horror Picture Show. They carry him out on stage in a coffin. He jumps out with a chain, starts whipping the audience. There's two guitar players, and they both dress like witches. And it's like death rock. And it's not amazing yet, but it's getting there, and I think it might be amazing. So this is Zorn. This is a track off their new EP. Well, they're putting out a new one tomorrow, too. They put out two EPs in like 2 months. But this is off their 7-inch EP, just called Zorn, I believe. And this track is called Intergalactic Queen. And we're back, and we're running long, but that's all right, baby. Adam White was not here last week, so we're happy to have him back. So we're always happy to spend some extra time with Adam, or Adam time. Adam, this is right up your alley, business. Let's see here. Citigroup released a report just yesterday, and basically it was an 88-page report, and I'm going to try to read the whole thing this weekend. Basically, it's an overview and actually a somewhat in-depth look into the music industry and consumer buying habits. Two things are important before we discuss this further. This looks at the North American music industry, or actually I think it's USA music industry as a whole. That is, be careful applying these generalizations to punk rock or any other specific genre. This is broken out, and of course, because pop and rock, but especially pop and hip-hop now, are so huge, all the results here are going to be heavily skewed by those genres, because those are by far the biggest genres these days. So anyway, Citigroup's report said that in 2017 in the United States, $43 billion was generated by the music industry. That actually represents somewhat of a rise from over the past 10 years. It's the highest we've seen since 2006. And of course, since the rise of the internet, the music industry has tanked. So it looks like the music industry is finding out how to get money once again. However, the way the music industry is finding out how to get money is not really beneficial towards the artist. Of that $43 billion, actual artists only receive 12% of that income. The rest goes to companies. The rest goes to middlemen. The rest goes to promoters, corporations, shareholders, and the like, and distributors, and the like. However, to be fair, in 2000, only 7% of the income went to musicians. Now we're up to a mighty 12%. Unexpectedly, physical sales have continued to drop since 2009. However, and this is the figure that I think bears the greatest risk of being distorted and misinterpreted. People are spending more on concerts than ever before, by far, and that number has skyrocketed since 2009. So people say, oh, people are going to concerts more often and are more likely to go out to music. That most likely is not accurate, because since 2009, the price of tickets has skyrocketed as well. So one of the weaknesses of this report, if you ask me, is it is unclear as to whether or not people are going to more concerts or people are just spending more per concert, which I think is the more likely event, especially since these results are so heavily skewed by pop and hip-hop, which are very expensive ticket-wise these days. And even big rock acts is very expensive ticket-wise. Adam White, 12%. Is that good and fair, or should we do better?
No, that's horrible. The problem with this kind of report, or by looking at things this way, is I feel that like that kind of like embarrassing number should be assumed. Like, was this news to you, or would you have assumed this?
It was news to me, only because I hadn't really thought about it. Like, I mean, I'm fully aware that in the 90s and early 2000s, bands got about 80 cents per CD. So that's about 12%, you know what I mean? But I guess I never really thought about in the context of concerts and stuff. Honestly, if you would just ask me off the top of my head, I would have said, of all money generated by music, I would say artists probably got about 40%, and I would have been wrong.
Yeah, which even that, I mean, it's one of those things where you would expect the value to be based on the irreplaceable part of the equation of you'd expect it to be based on the linchpin of it, the thing that is actually attracting everyone. So one would expect that it would be like the musician and then everyone else, because without the musician, none of that happens, right? You take them out, you can get a bunch of concert promoters in a room together, but it's not something that you'd want to go hang out with. So but we all knew that, right? We all knew that the lot of the musician was pretty shitty, and you know, that was the reality of it. I would love for something like this to, instead of just looking at it in some sort of big aggregate number where we can all look at it and go like, ooh, and then walk away, to actually approach this from a bit more of a nuanced standpoint, where we can actually say like, you know, all right, if we wanted to maybe do something about that, how does that break down then? Like, you know, like if you looked at, say, you know, small club shows, categorize those in one way, break it down that way. Big concerts, break it down that way. Streaming revenue, break it down that way. Is the kind of thing that can probably be attacked by not lumping all those numbers together. Because as you said, you're going to get presumably, you know, bands playing $10 shows at a bar are included in the same equation here as, you know, the Foo Fighters playing a baseball stadium, and I don't know if that helps anyone, or if just the massive amount of money that's involved at the one end of that scale just, you know, fucks it up and washes everyone else out.
I think from 7 to 12%, that's a substantial change. It's still not good, but it's still, I mean, that's almost double from where it was in like less than in about a decade. My question, though, about the the live music sales is, okay, people are spending money, a lot more money on festivals and concerts, but isn't that a little deceptive because fees have skyrocketed in probably the same amount of time?
Well, it all depends how they're breaking it down, which we don't really know, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, this is an 80-page report, so perhaps all this detail is in those 80 pages. We're just looking at the summary.
They do not address that issue. I look for that issue specifically. So listen, can we do better? Yes. Will we do better? Who knows? The big point of this thing is more than, people are spending more money on music than ever before, which really did surprise me. Many people are spending money on streaming service, which blows my mind. I don't think I would ever pay. Well, I wouldn't say ever. But it's hard for me to fathom a circumstance in which I pay money for. I don't even use streaming services. But
I don't either.
But basically, fans need to say, well, listen, I can figure out a way to make my money go directly to the artist, or I can just get convenience and at the cost. I mean, I can ask for convenience at the sufferation of the artist himself. And the vast majority of fans choose to let the artist suffer for their own convenience.
Here's the one thing I'm curious about here too, is that how they're qualifying spending money on music. Because I'm going to use like my direct example of, say, my last weekend. So we traveled to go to a music festival. So we bought a plane ticket. We, you know, got accommodations. We ate at restaurants or at food vendors or whatever while we were there. We drank a bunch of beer. We probably did a minimal amount of shopping, but we, you know, participated in the local economy in the place that we went. In my head, if I was making a budget, you know, I would say, well, that whole vacation there was related to music. But at the same point, it was, you know, it was a festival, so we paid, you know, whatever it was, $80, $100 or something for a ticket to go in. And then everything else was just, you know, merch table stuff was any of the direct sort of like band money that have went out. So if you're looking at it from that standpoint, how much are they lumping in all of that sort of like travel and tourism money into this mix?
The answer is they're not.
Okay.
The figure is it arrived at by adding these three numbers together: physical sales and permanent digital downloads, paying money for concert tickets and merchandise, and streaming subscription. Those three figures.
Oh. Hmm.
I
think there's some argument to where you can go and you can look at it and say like how much of like a. How much is the artist getting out of like overall revenue generation that happens because of their stuff? But all right, that's not in it, and that's not in it. I don't know. Buy more T-shirts, kids.
Yeah. Two quick things. Adam says the most indispensable part of this equation gets the least. I don't know if I agree with that contextualization, because now we are in a period of pop music where our pop stars are extremely fleeting. That is, a pop like this guy Post Malone is huge. He'll be gone in 6 months. No one will even know of him. You know what I mean? So I would say in the hip hop, in the pop, and even in the rock, like 5 Seconds of Summer, if you want to call that rock, these guys are all very dispensable. And I think for some reason, music fans and even independent music fans have embraced marketing, and they'll say, "We'll love whatever you say we should love." And by accepting that, the pop star himself or herself is extremely disposable, because whoever the money behind the artist says you should love, the fans are loving. Like, people love Post Malone. I can't figure out why. People loved Lil Yachty. I couldn't figure out why. People love Cardi B. I cannot figure out. Cardi B is dreadful. I'm a huge Nicki Minaj fan. To me, Cardi B is Nicki Minaj without all the talent, style, and cleverness. I don't understand it. I honestly don't understand it. I think that's a big part of it. Second thing, though, is that there's the counter-argument, which this is not my counter-argument, although I agree with it 100%, is I saw someone on Twitter once say, when physical sales went away, all the rock bands said, boo-hoo-hoo, physical sales going away, you should give us money, boo-hoo-hoo. Where the hip-hop artists said, okay, we'll give our music away for free and we'll make money through other avenues. And in a way, that was the right maneuver, from a pure strategy standpoint, because hip-hop guys out there are still getting paid. Rock bands generally are not, unless your name is Dave Grohl. So, I don't know. That's that. Anyway, pay for bands. Oh, one last thing. Adam and Ricky, do you have an idea of what bands of what percentage of income generated from punk news events do bands get?
30%, 40%?
Adam White?
Based on my understanding, all?
About 100%. So I got to say, punk news, that's pretty good. 100%. That's not bad. That's not bad.
As yeah, we are really, really good at not making money.
Sometimes it's 110%. It costs me money.
Yeah, actually, this report, it was originally 11.8%, but since that happened, it's now we push it over to 12.
Well, speaking of bands getting ripped off, as you all know, a little while ago, Target opened up a store on the East Village in New York City, and they made a, I guess you want to call it an homage to CBGB, except for they had a store awning that instead of saying CBGB, said TRGT. A lot of people got upset, and a lot of other people said, Target is great. You shouldn't say anything bad about Target, which baffled me. Well, Target issued a response. They said, we often host one-day celebrations that shows the neighborhood how excited we are to be a part of their community. Because if there's one thing that Target does, it's unite communities and not completely annihilate the other small businesses that are there. We sincerely apologize if some event goers felt it was not in the best way to capture the spirit of the neighborhood. We always appreciate guest feedback and will take into consideration as we plan for opening events. A lot of emotions all over the place here. I'm just going to say one thing and then let you guys respond. One thing I saw all over the internet at punk news and other places, people were saying, people get outraged over anything these days. You know, those snowflakes getting outraged over this. And I think the comment of people will get outraged over anything, I think what that's supposed to be attacking is that you are damaging expression and culture because you wanted to protect people's feelings. That argument being applied to here doesn't make any sense because Target is not a culture or self-expression. Target is a business. So I feel people are getting dumber. I feel people are just using arguments that don't even fit into the argument they're trying to make. That's what I'm saying. People are getting stupider.
I would totally rock a TRGT shirt.
Yes,
I've expressed this on past podcasts. I would. There is something so like horribly nihilistic about it wearing it would just be like past the point of irony to where it's kind of cool again. Like it's the whole enchilada, John. I'd wear it.
Yeah, I totally agree with Adam on that point. I think, you know, listen, was this like awkwardly done? Kind of. Yeah, it was. I don't think they needed to apologize for something that was sort of just some awkward execution. I think that's what, John, maybe you're talking about. I don't side with calling people like the names you were talking about. It was just like this was pretty innocuous compared to like the rest of the world. This seemed like if you're getting really emotional about this and angry, then you probably should get like a hobby or something, because this isn't a fight worth fighting for. And in the end, what happened was you get the Streisand effect, and then you get me and Adam buying TRGT shirts for the irony.
Well, here's where I would like where I think that I feel like Target shouldn't have bothered to apologize or come up with some reason. They should have just said,
"Target was in the right." Do you think Target was?
I don't think they were in the right. I think it was a boneheaded thing to do, but I think that like they're people aren't. People are of course mad because they're appropriating this and like trying to, you know, pick up something that was like, you know, got some rock and roll cool and apply it to their dumb corporate thing. But that's a very 90s way of thinking about it. I would say that like the issue here is more so not that Target is, you know, appropriating rock and roll iconography. I think the issue is more that they're appropriating rock and roll iconography of something that has been lost to gentrification. So, you know, it's not something that by apologizing for taking the symbol that they're going to take away the sting of, you know, the fact that, hey, now there's a target in this, you know, in the East Village to eat up all the business from your small businesses that it has to compete with, right? Like, if they're going to address why people are, you know, miffed about this, then you can't properly do that without addressing the whole, you know, big corporation putting a big corporate store in a city that, you know, is quickly changing, and all of the social pressures that addresses. So Target is not going to fucking address that, because they're still going to put a Target in this area of New York. So there's no way they can sincerely, you know, address why people would find this distasteful, because the sincere way would be not to put a Target there. So don't bother then. Like, they should have responded with that, like, person shrugging emoji, because they were still going to put their Target there anyways. So, you know, oh well, you didn't like our stunt, but okay, we're still putting a Target here, so fuck you. And, like, that would be more honest to me.
It'd be more than punk rock too, I think.
Well, it'd just be the more honest answer, like, then oh, we're trying to, you know, celebrate in the, what did they say here, that shows the neighborhood how excited we are to be part of their community. Fuck you. Like, if you were excited to be part of their community, you would probably not have put a Target there. So well, because also, not out of the question, and you are going to put a Target there, then don't feed people platitudes.
I mean, also think about this. They do that. They put the sign up, and I was just Googling, seeing like what other outlets cover this, and it was a few others. I didn't even realize that this was like a big thing, because of the outrage that some people had about the CBGB sign that they had. Now everyone in the world knows that there's a Target in the East Village, and now because of all that outrage, they now had a bunch of free advertising, so everyone knows that there's a Target there now.
Yeah, but that's a poor mentality, because under that mentality is, if an entity does something bad, you shouldn't report on it because you give that more press. But that's a bad mentality, because that means entities or people can do bad things without notice and get away with it because they'll get press. And honestly, did Target sell any more items because websites like us and Brooklyn Vegan posted this? No. So it's not, believe me, Target does not want negative press in regards to this. They're a large international corporation. Those guys never want negative press, you know. Joe Corey wants negative press. Target does not want negative press.
It's probably largely because an organization that is that size, right, everyone's got to prove that they're doing their job. So we can look at it and go, you know what, like the funny thing, or the punk rock thing, or the thing that would just make it like go away, is that Target would have probably like taken down the TRGT sign, put the shrug emoji out there, and just moved on, because they're still putting the Target there, right? And
yeah,
we can say that. The real issue is that, like, well, no, there's someone that works in PR, and they work in this, you know, division of the PR department, and that their job is to monitor for negative things that are being said about them, and they've got to prove to their boss that they're doing their job, so they got to make sure that they write up something that is, you know, going to sufficiently sound community-oriented, and it's just a bunch of fucking people justifying their jobs.
Then at the end, when they come out with that product, then you got HR to look it over for everyone and then send it back.
Well, speaking of sending people back,
it's
two guys went somewhere and they got sent back. Unfortunately, I have a less fun addendum to this article. The article, which was reported by Deutsche Welle, which is a German publication, said two elderly residents escaped from a nursing home and they went to Wacken. They got to Wacken, the world's largest heavy metal festival, or close to it. The headliners of this year's Wacken were Judas Priest, Danzig, Sepultura, pretty good. So the two nursing home residents got there. People at Wacken said, oh man, these old guys shouldn't be here, they're in danger. People called the nursing home and the cops showed up and got the two elderly residents back to the nursing home safe and sound. Also, there were very few arrests at Wacken, so good for Wacken and good for the Germans. Maybe the United States country always could take a hint or two from that. However, that's not the real story, unfortunately.
Hello?
Hello?
The real story is the following. I was going to see how long you guys would hold out. The real story...
I'm like, oh, God, horrible audio things are happening.
The real story is that I think Deutsch Vell was playing a little bit of a prank. The guys didn't... The original story was two people escaped from a nursing home, which even we changed to left a nursing home. You don't escape from a nursing home. Basically, it was actually a substance rehabilitation facility, and they weren't like 90, they were like 50, and they purposely went to Vakken to check it out, and they got hauled back to the substance rehabilitation center after people saw them. So it wasn't two nursing home residents, it was substance rehabilitation residents.
Oh, that's less fun, because I'm expecting, like, cool grandpa here. Although you could totally escape from a nursing home.
Well, what do you mean you can leave a nursing home at your will at any time?
Nah, I mean, my grandfather, at the end of his life, he had dementia, so he was, like, in a nursing home where you could not leave, because if you did, he'd just fucking wander away. So there are certain times where you are in a nursing home when you cannot leave.
Well, fair enough. Well, anyway, yeah, I mean, everybody got duped by this story. Listen, who thought we couldn't trust the Germans, Adam? I mean, I was surprised. I thought you could always trust them, you know.
John, it's too soon. Don't make fun of the Germans.
I love the Germans,
yeah,
Adam.
Yeah, all right. So that didn't happen. Shit. What are you going to do? Ricky.
Yeah.
We've been duped by
the Germans again.
By Germany once again, so just bring us back.
All right, so I don't have anything new to bring to play a song, but I've been wanting to play in a somewhat old school Morning Glory song for a while. One of my favorite releases ever is the Whole World's Watching release that they put out, I believe, in 2004 or 2000. Let me see here. Is this 2000? Yeah, 2004. Okay. So here is the song "The Whole World's Watching" from the Whole World's Watching release by Morning Glory. Enjoy. We'll be right back.
glad we're back, and that was an old Morning Glory track. Morning Glory is on hiatus right now, but they will always be a classic in my mind. Let's talk about a modern classic, The Nightbirds. They've released a new music video. The new music video is called My Dad is the BTK. That's Blind Torture Killer. It's off their upcoming album called Roll Credits. It's a mini album. I think it's 8 tracks. That's out September 21st. What did you guys think of this video?
Fucking hilarious. I thought it was... I've been listening. The song has grown. I really liked the song when it first came out, but I gotta tell you, I'm liking it more and more. I think right now it's one of my top one or two. Definitely my top three most look. One of the most looked forward to albums of the year, at least for me. It was funny. I mean, I love these music videos that don't have a lot of production value. Has a sense. It was cartoony. They didn't need to put a lot of money into it. I don't think they did, but they did, and they did such a good job with what they did. I thought the memoriam for C. Soto at the end was really nice. But it was funny. They were having fun. It was gruesome, sort of in a gross Misfits way, and that's sort of par for the course with Nightbirds. I do have a separate question about the album, though, and I was thinking about this before before we started the podcast, and this is, it's an eight, Roll Credits is an 8-track album, but my question is it an 8-track album, or is it seven songs plus, like, one instrumental that we usually, like, an instrumental that we usually get from Nightbirds when, okay. Well, usually we do get at least one from them.
I see what you're saying. I think not on this one. I would guess no. But it actually is probably more likely yes. If this is kind of a quicker release, instrumentals are easier to write and record than lyric songs. So you might be right.
True.
But I'm going to guess no.
Okay.
We have a wonderful spectrum of music videos that came out this past week that show the difference between when the art of making music videos was actually cool and the sort of the horrible present in which we live. So John removed the story about it already.
No. Oh, I can put it back if you want.
No. I'll just going to bring it up to insult it. So there was a video that was posted for the new Alkaline Trio song, which is called, I don't know, it's probably a pun. And so
This Blood's On Me.
This was, what is it called?
I just made that up. This Blood's On Me. I just made that up.
Well, this blood's, yeah, sure, right? Something like that. So this new Alkaline Trio song, to speak nothing of the quality of the song, let's talk about the video. The video is
stupid.
Some imagery that is sort of floating around, and then the lyrics to the video are to the song, appear atop the imagery as it goes by. So it is a very like modern day lyric video of the kind that I hate and make me want to die. Slightly better, only because I don't feel like I'm being insulted, was the video for the new Suicidal Tendencies song Fubar, which, to me, it embraces exactly the reasoning for these kind of videos to exist, which is that the kids these days are just listening to fucking music on YouTube. They use YouTube as the radio. They will go and just listen to song after song after song on YouTube. They're not looking at it for a lot of it. They're just using it as an audio player. The very concept of doing that strikes me as relatively insane, but that's what people do. So in the case of the Suicidal Tendencies song, it's just like the album cover, the most minimal amount of movement in that, like, they added like a little equalizer effect just to make it not a completely static image, but that's it. So it is there because they're expecting people are going to go to YouTube and use YouTube as a stereo. So fine.
Yeah.
The Alkaline Trio is the exact same thing, with the conceit that they had a little bit more money, so they went out and they got an animator to go and animate a thing for it. I feel like the lyric videos are just sort of like a, you know, they don't want to do an actual video, or at least not at this point. They do want to just acknowledge the fact that people are using YouTube as a stereo. So they go, well, what do we do? Well, what can we do? That's the medium between, you know, between nothing and actual music video, and lyric video is what happens. So we get lyric videos, which I don't know. I've talked about for years as being idiotic. But you know, so we've got that. We have the completely static image, and we have this wonderful Nightbirds video that it's from the 90s, right?
Oh, I would say it's like 87 or 88.
Yeah, it's like an old Beastie Boys video. Or something like that. It's just like the band dressing up in costumes and goofing around,
and it's hilarious.
But actually telling a story. It's not a performance video. It's not a fucking lyric video, right? And it's them actually like going and making a concept and like putting some effort into it, and it's incredibly engaging. And when I actually said I hadn't watched it before this show, and you guys had asked me to go watch it, and I was sort of glued to watching it, right? And that is very rare with me in music videos, especially when the videos are a lot of the times just a bunch of abstract bullshit going on, where I don't actually need to look at what's happening. So from a filmmaking standpoint, like, congratulations, Nightbirds has nailed the fact that like you sometimes want a narrative to the thing that people are watching.
Actually, you know, the Nightbirds thing actually might be a better marketing thing, because there's references hidden throughout it, and I watch it like four times to see how many references I could catch. There's the obvious Suicidal Tendency one, there's Beastie Boys one, I'd say, there's, what do you call it, Seinfeld, Pee Wee Herman, so there's like references like hidden throughout the whole
thing. Where was the Seinfeld one?
There's a Seinfeld mug and some other things, with they love Seinfeld. Oh, also, oh. There's reference to Maine for the Masses in it, which is funny. One thing, let's briefly talk about the Suicidal Tendency, and then we're going to talk about another music video one. Suicidal Tendencies, their new album is a re-recording of a 1996 Mike Muir solo album. Often, bands will re-record classics albums, such as Fear, re-record their first album. Suicidal Tendencies famously re-recorded their first album, and it was terrible. Here, the band is re-recording not one of their classic albums, but one of their worst albums. I mean, I think everyone agrees it's always a bad idea to re-record a classic album, because what's the point? The Dead Boys just did it. What's the point? But how about re-recording a terrible album in an attempt to make it good?
I can't think of another example of that happening.
Rush
so,
remixed
I mean...
Vapor Trails because it was so bad like 5 years later.
Yeah, but like, was there any saving it? Because wasn't it more that it was just like recorded in this overblown wall of sound, not a wall of sound, but like, you know, Volume Wars context in the first place. So there wasn't much they could do about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, there is. I think if you are a fan of the band, I think there is something of interest here. I think that there's a huge leap to actually make it something compelling for anyone that isn't already a fan. So if, you know, when they were around still, you know, the Clash got together and they said, you know, we're going to do Cut the Crap, right? I would be very interested in going to hear that. However, I'm a big fan, so I am unsure if the general music going public would have as much interest in something that's such an odd duck.
Yeah.
The real question is that, like, are they re-recording this material because they love it, because they think it didn't get its due,
or are they just
doing it in lieu of going and writing new songs that people like?
Yeah. Well, no answer to that, but I think we all know the answer. For me, there's only one way to re-record an album, and that's live. You know, that gives it a different context, a different feeling. But studio-wise, it's like what's the point? You know, I'm not necessarily opposed to a band like re-recording their greatest hits as almost like a pseudo live record, which can work, but you got to be be very careful when you do that. You got to do it right. Let's just wrap up a couple last things here. I do want to cover this Integrity video. Integrity released a video for their Geism cover or Geism cover of Document One. Adam, wait, who is Geism?
They're a 80s Japanese kind of like metal punk fusion band, really,
and,
not?
Indeed they are, Adam. Very good. Geism along with Zao, they're kind of the two main Japanese early hardcore satanic bands. Although I guess Geism isn't technically satanic, but they basically are. This is off their split with Krieg. This video got a very mixed reaction from the public. Adam and Ricky aren't really Integrity fans, and I don't think they're Geism fans either. I asked them to watch this video because I'm interested in their response. The video had a very specific idea behind it, and most people didn't get it. So the question was, is that a failure on the artistic view, or is that a failure of the populace to, you know, not comprehend everything that's not spoon-fed to them?
Well, all right, so I did not get the concept, but you you telling me that people were outraged or something, I was expecting something controversial about it.
There's nothing controversial about it. What I'll say is people said the video looks stupid and cheap.
It struck me as cheap. But it struck me as cheap in that it is a video that a rock band made, not cheap in that like you know, why didn't this have the production value of Thriller was not going through my head when I was watching an Integrity video. So I mean, I recognize that it was done for maybe lesser money, in that it's a fairly static video. It is the guitar player and the vocalist standing next to each other performing the song while some video effects happen behind them. But, you know, I was not offended by this. So what is the concept, and what were people all that, like, people were just worried that it was cheap?
The concept was, it's actually a very accurate homage to early 80s metal videos. Slayer's earliest videos, Megadeth's earliest videos, Anthrax's earliest videos look almost identical to this. And so the idea was, is because the band is paying tribute to their roots, they're paying tribute to their music roots, Geism. But they thought visually they would pay tribute to their American roots and do one of these bootleg music videos from the early 80s that look just like this. People did not get it. But is that a question because people that were into heavy metal in the 80s are now 45 and 50, so they're not looking into this, and younger people don't get the reference? Is that the issue? Or is this really clever and it's just above people's heads?
It went above my head. I mean, I wasn't outraged by it, but I thought when you told us to watch it and not look at the comments, I thought we were supposed to find some sort of deeper meaning in this, and I just wasn't finding it. The fact that this was an ode to, you know, early videos, that's totally fine with me. I don't see why people would be, I mean, if it went over the head, people would be pissed off, I guess.
People weren't mad that it was an homage to early 80s videos. People didn't get that it was an homage to early 80s videos, and they thought it was just like a cheap video.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of, I guess that's just their ignorance on it, I guess, but I went in there with the same ignorance. I wasn't put off by it or anything like that. But now that I have more context for it, I'm fine with it. Not a lot happened in it for a video. That's the thing, and maybe that's just my inexperience with this genre. But there wasn't a lot going on. Like, I didn't feel the need to have to watch the entire thing if I wasn't watching it for this podcast, you know.
I mean, it has the quality of something that you would see at 2 a.m. on the, whatever, like, the metal hour is, when you were, like, sitting at a CRT tube TV when you were a kid watching music stuff, right? So, from that standpoint, I get the artistic vibe that they're shooting for there. But, I mean, Ricky's right. It's not a... It is not compelling, say, from 1 minute to the next. You know, they could have. Where's the razzmatazz, John? Is what we're asking for. But
the pizzazz. That's what
the pizzazz. Yeah. On the other hand, though, given that people are, again, I'm going to circle back to my hatred here. Given that people are totally fucking fine watching the musical equivalent of a lava lamp with some words on top of it, there's at least more going on in this integrity video than that. And 90% of the videos that we see are just that lava lamp thing. So, you know, if this is the kind of thing that you have to go on the internet and complain about, you need to find like bigger targets for your rage.
Really, you think people complaining about the internet are complaining about things that's not worth complaining about, and they could be using their time better? Really, Adam? Listen, I thought
that's my hot take on modern society, John.
I thought if this was the only kind of video they did, I would think it'd be a little disappointing. But I do like how every move that integrity makes has a specific purpose, and I do like how they hide stuff and make references in my experience. Music and art that you don't get right away is almost always the most rewarding art, and so I think that's what's kind of cool about this. It's kind of like a secret message, even though the message is right there in front of you. So Integrity's cool. The new EP is cool. The last album is amazing. Howling for the Nightmare Shall Consume. You guys want to wrap this up with a song, or you guys want to cover any of these last couple of stories? Let's play a tune.
Whatever.
Go ahead, Ricky. Which one do you want to cover?
All right, here.
Adam, what were you going to do?
I was going to play a song and get us the hell out of here.
All right, let's
do it.
Song it up.
Just be ruthless, Ricky. You got to be ruthless. Speaking of ruthless, there's a hardcore band out of Toronto called Piper Marrow. P-I-P-E-R space M-A-R-U. They've been around for, I think, just this year. They played their first hometown show in Toronto back in May. They have their first EP out right now. It's called Most of My Friends Died in Space. The people cool that title. Know about... Yeah, it is cool. The people that know about hardcore, and I do not, but the people that seem to know are calling this, like, this is the hot new band in the Toronto hardcore scene right now. This is the band everyone's getting out to see. So you want to get on the trolley early, you should get on this Piper Maru train now. So I'm going to play the first song off of here. It's called Fragile. It's about white fragility. So there you go. So here you go. This is Fragile by Piper Maru out of Toronto, and I'm sure I've pronounced their name four different times since I started talking. Here we go.
At night, just before sleep, as you lay by yourself in the dark, how do you feel about yourself? Are you proud of your behavior? Are you ashamed of your behavior? Yeah.
that was Peeper Moreau. Now I'm Piper Marrow at Track by Adam. We're wrapping this up. Tricky Ricky, any last words? Anything people should check out? Anything that's happening? What's going down? What's slipping? What's flopping? What's dropping? What's electroshocking?
You can pre-order my upcoming book at imoutofherebook.com. I'm still working on that. It's coming along nicely.
Adam White, any last words for the people and Punk News' is remarkable 100% payment rate to bands?
The second we break that, we're going to be sellouts. So if we we're going to do a show where we're going to say, you know what, we're going to try to cover the cost of this of the damage that one of you dicks did by jumping off this thing, and then we're going to be sellouts, John.
Yeah, a certain magazine will publish a completely incorrect tirades about how we're sellouts, even though they take money from advertisers and we don't really.
Anyways, yeah. So fuck everyone else. Podcast@thepunknews.org. If anyone wants to send us email, that's how you do it. With your email program. Not with like a bird or something, that won't work.
Egypt.